And now, Planet Seniors with your host, Rita Vanacore.
I've paid my dues time after time. I've done my sentence but committed no crime. And bad mistakes I've made a few.
Everyone, and welcome to Planet Seniors. I'm your host, Rita Vanacore. We're here at Radio Kingston, WKNY, every Monday evening from 8 to 9 p.m., and it's Planet Seniors. It's all about us, so I try to bring you the best information I can for us, and also that little information that we may just not get to because we don't read those papers or whatever. So anyway, welcome. Happy President's Day, by the way. This is a legal national holiday, so good for you guys that get to stay home and not go to work and get paid anyway. But before we get on with our program this evening, I have a very interesting program that's going on, but I want to share with you something. There are some presidents that stand out in my mind. One of them is Abraham Lincoln, and because he's part of President's Day, I did a little research and came up with some very interesting information about President Lincoln. And so I thought I'd share with you, before we get on to our guests, some information about President Lincoln, 10 things you may or may not know about President Lincoln. And I think some of the stuff is pretty interesting. Did you know, for example, that Lincoln is enshrined in the Wrestling Hall of Fame? Who would have thought it? But the great emancipator wasn't quite WWE material, but thanks to his long limbs, he was an accomplished wrestler as a young man. Defeated only once in approximately 300 matches, Lincoln reportedly talked a little smack in the ring. According to Carl Sandburg's biography, Honest Abe once challenged an entire crowd of onlookers after dispatching an opponent. "I'm a big buck of this lick. If any of you want to try, come on and wet your horns," was what he said. There were no takers, and Lincoln's grappling exploits earned him an outstanding American honor in the National Wrestling Hall of Fame. So how about that? And here's something else. Lincoln created the Secret Service hours before his assassination. On April 14, 1865, Lincoln signed legislation creating the U.S. Secret Service. That evening, he was shot at the Ford Theater. Even if the Secret Service had been established earlier, it wouldn't have saved Lincoln. The original mission of the law enforcement agency was to combat widespread currency counterfeiting. It was not until about 1901, after the killing of two other presidents, that the Secret Service was formally assigned to protect the commander-in-chief. So, another thing, grave robbers attempted to steal his corpse, but the Secret Service did come to the aid of that and stopped them, and they moved Lincoln's body to a secret place where nobody could find him. But they did apprehend the grave robbers. They were going to ask for a $200,000 ransom, which in 1865 was a heck of a lot of money. Okay, John Wilkes Booth's brother. Now, we all know John Wilkes Booth was the assassin who killed our president. His brother saved the life of Lincoln's son. A few months before John Wilkes Booth assassinated Lincoln, the president's oldest son, Robert Todd Lincoln, stood on a train platform in Jersey City, New Jersey. A throng of passengers began to press the young man backwards, and he fell onto the open space between the platform and the train tracks. Suddenly, a hand reached out, pulled the president's son to safety by the coat collar. Robert Todd Lincoln immediately recognized his rescuer, the famous actor Edwin Booth, brother of John Wilkes Booth. Strange coincidence, huh? Lincoln was the only president to have obtained a patent. He obtained a patent by creating a method to keep vessels afloat when transversing in shallow waters through the use of an empty metal air chamber that was attached to the sides of the boat. For his design, Lincoln obtained a patent, number 6469, in 1849. How about that? Here's another one. Lincoln personally test-fired rifles outside the White House. He tested them. He attended artillery and cannon tests, and he met at the White House with inventors demonstrating different military prototypes. And he used the White House, the back lawn of the White House, for those testing sites. He also came under enemy fire during the Civil War in an actual battlefield, although he wasn't harmed in any way. Colonel Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was a future Supreme Court justice, yelled at him, "Get down, you fool," and Lincoln ducked just as artillery came right over the top of his head. We all know, or we think we know, that Lincoln was born in Illinois, but actually he didn't move there until he was 21. Poisoned milk killed Lincoln's mother. When Abraham Lincoln was 9 years old in 1818, his mother Nancy died of a mysterious milk sickness that swept across southern Indiana, which was where they were living before he was moved to Illinois. It was later learned that the strange disease was due to drinking tainted milk from a cow that had ingested poisonous white snake root. And last but not least, in the White House, there is a room called Lincoln's bedroom. Well, President Abraham Lincoln never actually slept in that bedroom. It was there that he met with his cabinet members and signed documents, including the famous Emancipation Proclamation. So, little interesting facts about our president that you may or may not have known. And so I'd like to tonight now introduce my guest to you. My guest is Stephen Yoder. Stephen is a freelance journalist whose main interests are criminal justice, education, and business in his writings that he does for different newspapers and news areas. Tonight, we're going to talk about his very interesting and informative article published in The River. The River is an online newspaper that I love, and if you go online, you might want to try it yourself. You can get a subscription, and you can listen and read to these interesting articles. The article was on New York State bail reform law. There's a lot of controversy around it. Before we get started, I would like to read a short excerpt from Stephen's story and welcome Stephen to our program this evening. I just found the article so interesting that I want to read this excerpt about how it really works before we get into the discussion of why people think it doesn't, if that's okay with you.
That sounds great.
Okay. So the little section in his article says, it's a story from a local public defender illustrating the difference reform has made. Lori Dick is a Legal Aid Society defense attorney who lives in Beacon and practices in Brooklyn, New York. In the summer of 2020, one of her clients, and we'll call him Jeff to protect his privacy, was getting his life together after being unhoused. He moved out of a shelter into a subsidized independent housing and had gotten a new job at the Shake Shack. One afternoon, he was on his way home from work when he got off the train in Brooklyn and he was stopped by the police. They told Jeff, who's black, that he fit the description of a person who allegedly committed a robbery a few blocks away, snatching a chain from someone. Jeff was adamant he was innocent. Even offered to have officers check his bags. The police brought the victim, who was white, to tell them whether Jeff was the perpetrator. The victim said yes, the identification happening through a car window while Jeff was surrounded by police. When Lori Dick first met Jeff at the courthouse, his first question was whether she could call his assistant manager and tell him why he'd be late for his shift. He also gave her the details of his movements on the days of the alleged crime and none of that seemed to matter. And what happened was it took about 4 months for it to be unraveled. But because we have this New York State bail law, which allows the judge to determine through nonviolent crime associations or suspects that he can let you go without bail. Jeff was let go without bail. He was able to go to work, to keep his housing, keep his job, and it was eventually resolved, but it took 4 months. If he hadn't had this behind him, he might have ended up in jail for how long, Stephen? What's the average incarceration if someone doesn't get bail or can't afford bail?
Well, that depends a lot, and it depends on the judge and depends on how fast that case moves. One interesting thing about Jeff's case is that he was actually innocent of that charge. Lori Dick, his wonderful attorney, went back and found video footage showing that he absolutely could not have been at the scene of that robbery. And that case took 4 months to resolve. Theoretically, had a judge set bail, Jeff had no money, no family, so he would not have been able to pay bail. He could have been in jail those entire 4 months until that case was resolved. So he would have lost, you know, and you know, his – I'm glad you – I appreciate you reading that to start with, because I think in this bail reform discussion, what gets lost a lot of the time, there's a lot of talk about numbers and whether bail reform is driving up violent crime and so forth, and those are relevant conversations. We can talk about the actual data. But what gets lost are the people behind – who are being helped by this law. And Jeff is one of them. Their stories almost never get heard. So Jeff, he would have lost his job. He would have lost his housing, formerly unhoused person. Instead, because of bail reform, he was released. He got to go back to his job. He ended up getting a promotion. He's now a manager at Shake Shack. And, you know, Lori Dick said this absolutely, without bail reform, would have derailed him. So
yeah, and good for Jeff. Whoever he is and wherever he is, I'm so happy for him, because it breaks my heart when I hear these kind of stories. And also, you brought up a good point when we were talking, that most poor people, or not even poor people, you mentioned, and if I'm wrong, correct me, that the average person, if arrested, wouldn't even have $500 to come up with bail to get out of jail. Is that correct?
So that data, that is a national, that's a national figure that the Federal Reserve did this study. They do this study every year. It's a really interesting study, and it asks people whether they could afford a $500 emergency, an emergency charge, something they had to repair a car or pay a bill they didn't know about or so forth. And it ranges between 20 and 30% of the population in America who can't afford a $500 emergency bill. And so you can imagine, bail set $1,000, and we have data on this. I mean, in New York City, prior to bail reform, 90% of the people who were in jail in New York City who couldn't afford bail were facing bail amounts of $1,000. So, you know, you can see even low bail amounts mean that people are locked up. And again, you know, sort of the important point here, sort of reason behind bail reform is these are people locked up pre-trial, which means they're legally innocent. The only reason they're locked up is because they couldn't afford bail. So, there are a lot of – and so that means, as you're implying, that those who are locked up are disproportionately – who were locked up pre this bail reform law were disproportionately poor.
Yeah, and you know, I really believe in this law, but when this law first came out, and it just seemed that our elected officials seemed so vague on what it was, and we don't seem to be able to get the news coverage or whatever it takes to make these things explained in detail to the public to understand. So when something like this happened, when this law did come out, the opponents were so able to manipulate this the meaning of this law in so many ways. And of course, we live in a country now that if you see it on Facebook or one of your friends tells you, most people just believe it's true because they aren't going to be bothered to go any further.
Right. And, you know, it's a good point you make, and headlines drive a lot of public perception, obviously, about this. Well, you know, one thing I should probably do is back up and just explain bail for maybe those who
don't
know.
Let's go back there. Yeah. Let's talk about tell our listeners what this law entails and what it's supposed to rectify.
So bail is it's essentially like a refundable deposit, like you'd put down anytime you're trying to somebody wants a guarantee that you will do something. In this case, so a person gets arrested, they show up to court, a judge sets bail, and let's say it's $5,000, $1,000, $5,000, $10,000. You pay that amount, you can go free if you pay that amount. And the idea is, the way it works is if you show up to court, then you get that money back. If you don't, you don't. So that's the way in theory is supposed to work, which sounds like a good idea, but as we were just talking about, there was a study in 2016 found the people who are in jail who can't pay bail have an average annual income of $15,000 a year. So the advocates, what was front and center for the advocates of this new law was people should not be locked up just because they're poor. So what it did was it took bail decisions. It said that nonviolent crimes, misdemeanors, nonviolent felonies, and almost all misdemeanors, a judge no longer has the ability to set bail in those cases. Those people must be released. It did not touch violent offenses. So in other words, you're arrested on a violent crime. It does also, to add to that, it does not touch anything, any sexual offenses, any domestic violence offenses. So a person arrested on any of those charges, bail still can get set. A judge still has the ability to set bail in those cases. So it's only the nonviolent offenses that this law impacted. Within the first 3 months that it passed, jail populations in New York went down by 40%. So it had a big impact.
Stephen, let me ask you a question. When I listen talking about this and everything, okay, so somebody is suspected of robbing a bank, okay, and their bail is set at $500,000. And they meet their bail, and they're let go. Hmm. Now, somebody who was in effect suspected of robbing a grocery store or stealing someone's pocketbook, and they don't get bail because the law says that they can go free on their own recognizance to return for trial. What's the difference? They're both out of jail.
Hmm. Yep. That's right. And so theoretically, if bail made a big difference in the likelihood that those two sets of people, one person who can afford bail, one person who can't. If bail made a difference, and this is sort of the argument advocates made for this law, if bail made a difference in their likelihood of committing a reoffense or showing up to court before trial, then there's an argument for bail, but the data, we dug into New York State has really good data on this law. And kudos to the legislature for requiring the state to release that data. But when you compare, we looked at Ulster County, Westchester County, and Albany County, and in all three counties, the likelihood that somebody who was released because of this law would go on to commit a violent offense was 2-3%. And when you compare that, when you compare that to the folks who are released because they paid bail, they made bail, it's virtually identical. Those 2% are virtually identical. So bail, at least at this juncture, now of course, in 5 years, we could have more data, we have big studies that will tell us more. But certainly the states in which bail reform has passed, like New Jersey, this has been the case, that very few folks affected by these laws go on to commit any sort of violent offense.
Okay, so, and you mentioned it, and I think that we should mention again, because people need to hear this. People accused of violent crimes are not being set free without bail. Am I correct?
That's right. Yep, that's absolutely right. And, yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, you can, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, part of, and that's a, you know, that's what's, I think, a bit confusing for the public is police, prosecutors, and some politicians have been lobbying against this law even before it took effect. I mean, it was passed in April 2019. Already in December of 2019, it didn't go into effect till January of 2020. And already in December 2019, there were prosecutors and police who were releasing stories to the press, serving as sources for stories that claimed that that folks released on under this law were committing violence. There was a case in New York City of a woman who had some mental health issues attacking Hasidic women. That got quite a lot of press. The folks who are affected, folks who commit a violent, who are arrested on a violent crime are not impacted at all by this law. So what we're talking about, the argument is about this group of people who commit a nonviolent offense and then go on to commit some sort of violent crime. And that happened under the old system too. When people met bail, they got out. Sometimes they did commit a violent offense. But the stories that are getting into the public are – the stories that are making the press and making newspaper headlines are the stories that police are releasing to the press and not the stories like the one – I'm really glad you read that excerpt. Because those are not the stories that are not reaching the press. And in that sense, the advocates of this law are really are in trouble, in some trouble, because the sentiment is against is in favor of doing some kind of additional rollback to this law. And that's what it looks like the advocates are. Losing the public battle at this point, I would, in my
Well, you know what, though, Stephen, just think about it. You know, the advocates of justice for the average populace are much more quieter than the advocates for the other side of the coin. And I think that that's, you know, it's like you say in a newspaper, you never read good news in the newspaper because it doesn't sell. And I think that, you know, people like to get fired up about things that they don't understand, but especially if a policeman says it, well, of course it's true. Mm. You know, he said such and such and such and such. But have you ever heard of anyone, and I know I heard a couple stories of Rikers Island where a young teenager was held for an unreasonable amount of time before he was actually even brought forward to be even charged.
Yeah.
And those are the scary things. And, you know, unfortunately, and I've heard this said, and I hate when I hear it, but unfortunately, I think a lot of people believe it, and a lot of people see it that way, that if you're going to blame in this racist country an African-American or an Asian or a Hispanic or a Muslim, the first sentence I always hear is, they all look alike. And that is such a racist thing to hear, but I hear it over and over and over again. by people that are against these type of laws. And that's a scary thing to listen to when someone identifies someone. Look at all the people now that are getting out of jail. 20 years, 30 years, 18 years, now with DNA. And they were accused of crimes that they had no way of committing, but were jailed anyway because of what they are, not who they are.
Right. No, that's, yeah, I mean, you know, to give the public some credit, too, I mean, I agree with what you're saying. I mean, the disproportionately under the old bail law, the people who were getting bail set on them and the people who were getting the highest bail amounts, this was the judges who were doing this, obviously, were people of color. Disproportionately, I mean, there were a number of studies looked at this and compared, compared comparable people, identical situations, one having bail set, one not, one having higher bail set, one not, and the only difference was whether you're a person of color. So
right.
That was certainly happening. And, you know, to give the public some credit, I mean, the case that really sort of drove this bail reform effort was that of Kalief Browder back in 2015, a young man, 16 years old, accused of stealing a backpack. Police brought him down to the station, told him he'd just be held until his court date. Turned out he was there 3 years and much of that in solitary confinement. He ended up being released and told his family he was not all right when he got out, and he ended up committing suicide. And that outrageous case of a young man held on stealing a backpack for 3 years, it was the case that drove this whole effort. So I think people see, and I...
Yeah, yeah, I'm not calling the whole world bad.
No.
I'm just saying that there are certain scenarios where a sentence just gets heard over and over and over again. Let's just jump to, you mentioned that some new pieces were added in 2020 to this bail law to help clarify it maybe a little bit more. Can you just chat with us a little bit about that?
Right. Essentially, what those changes did, bail reform had not been in place for even 2 weeks before there was a group of opponents and a group of lawmakers who began talking about the need to change it. We didn't get even weeks to even see how the original bail reform law would work. So what ended up happening was Democrats, and with Governor Cuomo's agreement, signed a partial rollback of this law in April of 2020. And essentially, it took some categories of offense, a very narrow set of categories of offense, some drug offenses, one offense that involves a person who broke and entered and was in a living area at the time of arrest. So a few categories got that were not eligible for bail now became eligible for bail. So in other words, made those now, you know, a judge can now set bail on those. So it ended up increasing the jail population by on the order of, I want to say, 10 to 15%. So it had a big impact.
Wow.
And I would say, you know, I would have loved to talk to some, I did talk to one prosecutor for this story. I would have loved to talk to others. District Attorney Clegg, would have loved to talk to him. He was in favor of that rollback. He was in a recent event. He was in favor of that rollback. I haven't heard him take a position on further rollbacks of bail reform. So I don't know where he stands on that.
Right. Okay. And we're going to wrap this up. Steve and I so am happy that you chose to come with us, because I think that this is important for people to listen, more discussions about what's going on in the world, around the world, that could affect them one way or the other. And I understand that you live pretty locally to the Kingston area.
I live in the hamlet of Willow outside of Woodstock. We've been here. Going on 20 years.
Oh, wow. 20 years. Okay. I want to say thank you again. This article did appear in the online newspaper called The River. I love it. I read it. It's very interesting, and it has really spot on articles, some written by Stephen, some written by other talented journalists. So, Stephen, thank you again so much for joining me. I love chatting with you and learning more about this myself. So keep up the good work, and if I read something else, I just may call you and say, I need you back again.
I'd be happy to come back, Reed. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, Stephen. All right, we're going to take a short break, and we're going to listen to Bobby Darin with Mac the Knife.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth there, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie, babe, and it keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth big, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, wears old Maggie, babe. So there's never, never a trace of red. Now on the sidewalk, ooh, Sunday morning, lies a body just oozing life. Eek! And someone sneaking round the corner. Could that someone be Mac the Knife? There's the tugboat down by the river, don't you know? Where a cement bag just drooping on down. Oh, that cement is just, it's there for the weight to dare. Five will get you 10 old Mackies back in town. Now you hear about Louis Miller, he disappeared, babe, after drawing out all his hard-earned cash. And now Maggie spins just like a sailor. Could it be our boy done something rash? And Lucy Brown. Oh, the line forms on the right, babe. Now that Maggie's back in town. I said, Jenny Diver, whoa, Spooky Tawdry. Look out to Miss Lottie Lynn. And old Lucy Brown. Yes, that line.
This is Odell Winfield with exciting news from the A.J. Williams Myers African Roots Center. We are seeking our first executive director to lead the organization in collaboration with our board of directors and staff. Established in 2017, the African Roots Center has grown into a well-loved community center focused on culture, education, and social justice. Now we are looking for the person who will draw from our past to lead us into the future. A leader who knows that the problems that lie before us are not as strong as the ancestors who walk beside us. We strongly encourage Black, Indigenous, other people of color, LGBTQIA+, and formerly incarcerated people to apply. For more information, go to AfricanRootsLibrary.org and click on Employment Opportunities under Help Us Grow.
Don't fall in love with somebody that's helping you shovel fries under that fryer lamp.
Are you ready for the Black Meta? So before we submerge our hands in the rich, dark, living soil of the deep and its sweet, sweet Afrofuturism 2.0, damn.
More black, more meta. Beetle and Freedom Walker. Faster. Slower.
If you allow yourself to be sensitive to the environment, you will discover the subtle shades of meaning surrounding you. In other words, you allow yourself to be in a state of flow.
Expert analysis of our dystopian present.
I have every one of those symptoms.
No, I avoided that.
People are going to get interested now and go, hey, my gallbladder does interesting things. How do I know if it's well? And they're going to Google it and they're going to regret it.
The Black Meta. Tuesday afternoons from 1 to 3 here on Radio Kingston. AM 1490, FM 1079, and anytime at radiokingston.org. It could happen to you.
Come join an Undoing Racism Workshop for Kingston. It's hosted by the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond from February 25th through the 27th. In this workshop, you'll participate in a human-first process and create space to talk about how we've been socialized and conditioned to think about race and racism. You'll analyze racism in terms of class, power, and institutional structures first. Then you'll dig deeper, seeing how these larger structures affect our interpersonal relationships and how we all play a part in the systems that exist now. Undoing Racism is an intensive, interactive, virtual workshop held over the course of 3 days from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. February 25th, 26th, and 27th over Zoom. Space is limited and it is filling up quickly. It's going to be an interesting workshop. The cost is $350 for the weekend, and fundraising efforts for scholarships can be found by searching for Undoing Racism Workshop in Kingston, NY on GoFundMe. To register, visit psaib.org and click on What We Do. So for now, after that announcement, that sounds like a really good workshop. I think I might want to just jump in there and take it and do it myself. So I have a subject that I pulled. I pulled an editorial from a newspaper that I thought the editorial was really interesting. It was in a local newspaper, and it was written by a doctor. The editorial is entitled, "Thinking of Buying a Gun for Self-Defense? Don't Believe the Myth." Now, that's pretty interesting. So I pulled some facts first before we go into that article, and I will go over the article because I think it's fascinating. It's a point of view, but there's some information statistics that I think go along with that. So, for instance, did you know in the United States, for every 100 people, there are 120 guns? For every 100 people, there are 120 guns. It's estimated in the United States that out of 1 million gun-related incidences, about 10%, only 10%, are self-defense. For every one gun used in self-defense, there are 6 used to commit a crime. People use a gun for self-defense about 0.9% of all gun-related crimes. 0.9. That's what the self-defense thing is all about. Homicides inside the home with access to a gun are more likely to occur between spouses or households with children. If you think you have a gun in your home and your child doesn't know where it is, don't kid yourself. They do know where it is. And even small children as young as 2 and 3 years old do have the strength to pull that trigger. Guns kept in a home are more likely to be involved in fatal or non-fatal or attempted suicides within the home than to be used to injure or kill in self-defense. So let's remember that stuff as I go through this article and I'm going to read some of this stuff from the article because I think it's really important that we understand exactly where this doctor is coming from. And he says, during more than 25 years as an emergency medicine physician, I treated hundreds of patients with gunshot wounds. I treated criminals who shot each other. I treated gun owners who killed their family members in drunken rage. I pronounced dead suicide victims who shot themselves with an easily accessible handgun in their home. Yet in all the years of emergency medicine, I never treated a single patient who was shot by a law-abiding citizen in self-protection. Not once. Multiple reputable studies and surveys bolster what I observed. Choosing to have a gun in your home because it will keep you safe is a myth, and a deadly one at that. I just like to interject that because when people say to me, I have the right to bear arms because that's what the Constitution said. Well, the Constitution, remember, was already written way before the United States even was recognized as the United States. And we had the possibility of government, either British or French or other countries, coming into our homes and abducting us or killing us and our families. Now, yeah, I would have wanted a gun back then too, but remember they were using muskets that did one shot. So the danger there was not as severe as it is today. Suppose you have the same fears as 67% of primary gun owners, okay? You obtain a handgun. Which of these two scenarios do you think is more likely? Choose one. The gun you just bought will save your life from criminals or home invaders. Or two, that gun will be used to kill you or a family member, whether it means the murder of a family member or an accidental shooting or a possible suicide. Which do you think the gun is going to be there for? Well, the choice number two is by a landslide. In 2017, for example, according to the FBI reports, for every justifiable homicide, a defensive gun used in death, there were 35 criminal homicides. And that doesn't even include the thousands of deaths each year by suicide or accidental deaths occur when there's a handgun in the house. Where is the gun that will keep you safe? Where did that myth originate? Well, in his estimation, and again, this is his opinion written, it began with the powerful U.S. gun lobby, criminologist Gary Clack, and the economist and gun rights advocate John Lott Jr., who often quoted in the subject. Both rely on surveys regarded as highly flawed to claim that more than 2 million gun use deaths occur each year. Yet reportedly an analysis puts the deaths at around 2,000 a year, not 2 million. In the analysis of victims of gun violence from 2007 to 2011, the Department of Justice found that people were 9 times more likely to be injured or killed by a firearm rather than by protecting themselves. That's pretty interesting. Found that the people were 9 times more likely to be injured or killed by a firearm rather than by protecting themselves. But enough of statistics. Let's just use some common sense. What's more likely? That someone will break into your home and threaten your family, or that a member of your family, in a moment of anger or possibly even drunkenness, will resort to wielding that same weapon against you? Or that a member, in a moment of despair, a loved one, will turn easily to a very accessible gun and take their own life? Or that your 5-year-old, who knows exactly where you keep your gun, will accidentally shoot himself or another sibling? That's a very powerful editorial, I think, and with the statistics, again, and I'm saying, you know, these are my opinions. These are things that I think are more important for people to hear, not necessarily the opinion or judgments of the radio station or anyone that works there. Next, we're going to take a short break. And we are going to play All I Have to Do is Dream by the Everly Brothers. And we'll be back with what's happening in Kingston.
Dream.
Underwriting at Radio Kingston fuels our community fund, which helps Kingston community members in immediate need of financial assistance and supports other community initiatives. For more information about supporting the community fund, email underwriting@radiokingston.org.
Hi, it's Laura from the Kingston Farmers Market. You can find us every other Saturday, 10 to 2, this winter, inside the Senate Garage at 4 North Front Street in Uptown Kingston. You can still shop for fresh local fruits and vegetables all winter long. Everything is grown, raised, or made right here in the Kingston area. Masks will be required for entry and to be worn throughout your visit. No eating or drinking indoors. The market accepts SNAP and offers $2 Fresh Connect coupons and market currency. That's the Kingston Farmers Market inside the Senate Garage in Uptown Kingston. Every other Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. The market is looking for a site manager and food access coordinator to join our team. A great opportunity to work for a nonprofit with local food. Find out more about our events, job opportunities, and food justice programs at KingstonFarmersMarket.org or on Facebook and Instagram.
Hey, I'm Julie Novak. Join me Wednesday afternoons from 1 to 3 for No One Like You. How do you turn your kryptonite into your superpower?
There's this magic in naming yourself something that reminds you of your power. Hands is my name now. I do so much with my hands. I exist through my hands.
How do you go from hiding who you are to fully expressing yourself?
I started working as an actor very young. I would leave this environment that was hostile, that was dangerous, to going to this place where I suddenly had a function. I suddenly had value. I suddenly meant something.
No One Like You. Wednesdays from 1 to 3 p.m. here on Radio Kingston, AM 1490, FM 1079, and anytime at radiokingston.org.
Nibbling on sponge cake, watching the sun bake, all of those tourists covered with oil, strumming my six string. nothing to show but this brand new tattoo. But it's a real beauty, a Mexican cutie. How it got here, I haven't a clue. Wasted away again in Margaritaville, searching for my lost shaker of salt. Some people claim that there's a woman's blame. Now I think
happening in Kingston. Well, I have some interesting things that I think are important for everyone to hear. And let's talk about the Office for the Aging, because after all, we are seniors. So the Office for the Aging, in cooperation with AARP, is offering tax preparations and e-filings for you for your income tax, which means that you can literally make an appointment, take your information down to a volunteer who will do your taxes for you, e-file it for you at no charge, okay? So if you go to ulstertaxaid@gmail.com, and it's going to ask you to enter your name, the dates and times you'd like to have your appointment, your phone number, and which one of the sites you'd like your appointment at, they'll set it all up for you and let you know. There is another way to get your taxes done. The United Way is offering the same for people with an income that's less than $57,000 per year. And that's also free. So if you call the number 845-331-1199, that's 11999, extension 111, a lot of ones in there, you can get an appointment and you can have someone help you with your taxes. The Resource Center for Accessible Living is a great place if you have the need for temporary use of a wheelchair, crutches, a walker, anything like that. You can call them at 845-331-0541, and for a very, very minimal fee, they will allow you to rent the equipment that you need rather than purchasing it yourself. And let's get some exercise. Remember, seniors, when I say to you we play music on my program, I want you to get up and move, because it's so important to get those legs pumping. That's where all the blood goes back up to your heart where you need it. But every Tuesday at the Hudson Valley Mall, if you join the Office for the Aging at 9:45 a.m. in the food court, you'll go on a nice brisk walk with some other seniors, meet some new friends, have some fun, and get some exercise as well. The Office for the Aging also has attorneys available so that if you need consultation or referrals for problems that you might be having, that is also free to you. What's going on next week? Next week, we're going to be talking to Robert Langdon. Robert is the proprietor and the curator of Emerge Gallery and Art Space in Saugerties, New York. And as a venue, and this venue is for up-and-coming artists in the Hudson Valley. So we're going to be talking to Robert, how he came about with it, and what's going on in Saugerties that makes this place so special. So until next week, I'm going to say, be happy, be healthy, God bless. Please, please, please put your masks on. If you're in any place that's indoors, congested, people that you don't know, regardless of what is going on around us right now with whether we should or shouldn't wear a mask, seniors, we're the most vulnerable. So put your mask on. We're going to finish tonight with Jimmy Buffett and Margaritaville. Get up, move around a little bit and dance, and we'll see you next week.
Hey, where did we go? Days when the rain came.